Hey all, welcome back to the Real Life Pharmacology Podcast. I'm your host, pharmacist Eric Christensen, and I thank you so much for listening today. Hopefully you pick up a few clinical pearls along the way. And of course, speaking of clinical pearls, go check out reallifepharmacology.com and subscribe there, and I'll give you a 30-plus page PDF on the top 200 drugs, kind of a unique little study guide that I personally put together where I lay out important clinical pearls that you're going to see in clinical practice, as well as things that commonly come up on board exams and things of that nature as well. So if you've got anything to do with pharmacology, well, you're likely here for a reason. So let's get into it with the drug of the day today, and that is going to be tiotropium. And the brand name of this medication is Spiriva. Its primary use is in respiratory disorders, more specifically COPD. It's considered a long-acting anticholinergic medication, also referred to as a long-acting muscarinic antagonist. Sometimes you'll hear the term LAMA used as an acronym to kind of describe its classification. And this drug works by essentially blocking acetylcholine's action at muscarinic receptors, specifically M3 receptors or muscarinic 3 receptors. And when acetylcholine binds those M3 receptors, what it leads to is bronchoconstriction, so basically that airway closing up. And so if we prevent acetylcholine from binding those M3 receptors, we can help cause the opposite, which is bronchodilation or that relaxation of the airway there, which obviously allows for better breathing. Okay, so I said primary use is COPD. It can be used for asthma. It's typically a further down the line type of medication in patients that aren't controlled by, you know, typically our inhaled corticosteroids and things like that. But I think it is important to remind patients, regardless of the indication, and remind them that this medication is not meant for acute relief of symptoms. So it's not meant to be, you know, an albuterol or a quick-acting beta agonist that opens up that airway in an emergent type situation. Administration. So this is something I've seen be an issue in clinical practice. First, before I talk about that administration, I want to mention that there's two different Spiriva formulations. So there's a Handihaler and there's a Respimat. So the Respimat is a mist type inhaler where you press a button and you get that delivery of that mist, and the patient's supposed to inhale that, obviously. The Handihaler, I think, is a little bit more tricky, and I have definitely seen more issues with it. So it is a dry powder that's actually in a capsule. And what you do with that capsule is you put it in the Handihaler device, and the Handihaler basically punctures it and allows that dry powder to be inhaled out of that capsule. So now, obviously, if you can put yourself in the shoes of a patient looking at this device and seeing capsules, and you know, you could understand how there might be a little bit of confusion as to how that's done. And particularly with the capsules, you could definitely understand how a patient who's taken a lot of oral medications in the past might think, oh, well, I just swallow the capsule. Okay, and I have seen and heard of this as well from other pharmacists who've worked with patients. So really, really important to take the time, go through use of these devices, and make sure the patient has a good understanding of how to use it. One other quick story, I had a patient that severe lung disorder, very difficult time breathing, that type of thing, many exacerbations, things like that. And they obviously weren't responding to their medication. Well, it turned out he had Spiriva HandiHaler as one of his medications. And he was actually trying to open up the caps. He knew he had to use the HandiHaler device, but he was trying to open up the capsule and dump the powder into the device. So, again, just I want to emphasize that point. Be sure you take the time when you've got these unique devices and go through it. Make sure the patient knows what they're doing. As far as dosing goes, both of these devices are once daily dosing. So that is a potential advantage compared to, you know, twice daily dosing or multiple daily dosing that some other agents do have there. Now, adverse effect profile. So this is one that I did a little research on as I was, reviewing and preparing for this podcast. I wanted to know the percent absorbed systemically of tiotropium, because you see all these adverse effects potentially listed, and it's like, well, how common is it? And in clinical practice, the most commonly reported adverse effect that I hear patients report to me is dry mouth. Okay, so that is one that is going to happen. Hopefully, it's just a nuisance to patients, and you know, we can say, hey, you know, have a little water, or you know, whatever the case may be, that helps their dry mouth. Hopefully, that's just a short-lived thing for them, and not too concerning. Now, some of those other anticholinergic effects, we're going to need systemic absorption. So you think of, you know, urinary retention, dry eyes, confusion, things of those that type of nature, constipation. We're going to need systemic absorption and delivery via the bloodstream. And the percent absorbed is 19.5%. Bioavailable. So there is some systemic absorption with tiotropium. Now, I wouldn't call that incredibly significant. And in most patients who are reporting systemic anticholinergic effects, like I went through before, I'm going to look at their medication list. And in most situations, there's probably going to be other anticholinergic medications on their list. Whether it's, you know, an older antihistamine or a urinary anticholinergic such as, you know, oxybutynin or tolteridine, those patients are likely that are experiencing systemic anticholinergic effects probably aren't going to be experiencing it from tiotropium alone, okay? Not to say that it can't happen, but in general, I would say the likelihood is pretty low in general. I also wanted to mention elderly may be a little bit more prone to have that systemic accumulation, and particularly those with renal impairment, because a significant amount, if it is absorbed systemically, does get eliminated out through the urine. So in patients that have that worsening kidney function, which is many elderly patients, we could experience a little bit more accumulation and maybe a little bit higher chance that we run into those systemic anticholinergic effects. All right, so let's take a quick break from our sponsor, and I will wrap up with drug interactions. If you're in the market for pharmacist board certification study material, like pharmacotherapy, geriatrics, medication therapy management, ambulatory care, or the NAPLEX, definitely go check out meded101.com/store, STORE. In addition, if you're a nurse, med student, PA, nurse practitioner, go check out meded101.com/store. We've got links to Amazon books, Audible books, clinical practice pearls, things of that nature as well. So go check out all the links there. Support the sponsor, MedEd101.com, and help keep this podcast free and educational for all to enjoy. All right, so let's finish up on drug interactions. So when I see tiotropium, I don't think about drug interactions strongly. The most common interactions are going to relate to anticholinergic burden. So again, I alluded to that before, you know, your older antihistamines, your diphenhydramine, your hydroxyzine, your tricyclic antidepressants like nortriptyline or amitriptyline. These can all have kind of cumulative anticholinergic effects. Another potential adverse effect, drug interaction adding on to that anticholinergic effect of tiotropium, potentially with that minimal systemic absorption, you could have some impact and impairment on blunting the effects of acetylcholinesterase inhibitors that are used for dementia, such as donepezil, for example. And then one last situation, again, having to do with the anticholinergic effects, if we're using pro-motility type agents, such as a metoclopramide for slow GI motility, gastroparesis, there is potential that tiotropium could oppose that potential benefit and slow down the GI tract. So I think that gives you some sense of, you know, drug interactions, and I would say overall, I don't consider it very high on the totem pole of causing drug interactions, because we've got fairly low systemic absorption in general that we need to worry about there. So I think that's going to wrap up the podcast for today. Definitely go to reallifepharmacology.com. Take advantage of that free PDF. We also send out updates as to when we've got new podcasts and content available there. Leave us a rating, review on iTunes. Greatly appreciative to those of you who have already done that. And of course, share us with a friend, colleague, classmate, student, preceptor, and help us grow the audience so we can educate more and more folks about pharmacology. If you want to reach out to me, you can find me, Eric Christensen, PharmD, BCPS, BCGP. LinkedIn is probably the best way to track me down. Also, my email, mededucation101@gmail.com. If you have suggestions or comments or questions about things, I do my best to respond to all the emails I get. If you're asking a detailed question about something or a case, that's a little bit more challenging for me to keep up on that. And I do apologize for that, but to keep the podcast going and not drive myself crazy, I do typically don't provide recommendations on individual cases. But I appreciate those of you who have tried to ask about certain situations. So, with that said, thank you guys so much for listening. Take care, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.